Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, a 93-year-old World War II veteran remembers his time as a medical aide in the Pacific.
I said, "Doctor, get down, get down." And pretty soon, all I heard was thud. A sniper had shot at us. But we didn't hear the sound or nothing.
That wasn't the only close call. He's thankful he survived. And he'll share his emotional story today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9. Brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we remind you that no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who have done incredible things for the sake of our freedom. Every week we take a trip back in time and listen to stories from our greatest generation. We want our veterans to know that we appreciate them for their service and sacrifice. We want their stories to be preserved so we don't forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated. We're inspired. Maybe we laugh a little, too. And I think we might get a few chuckles today with Al Flores, because he has the tough memories, but the good memories from World War II. 93 years old. Now, you grew up, you were born in New Mexico. How old were you when you moved to Fresno, California?
2.
Now, I bring that up because I know that you got into the service before the war in the National Guard. You know what happened to all the guys from New Mexico who got in the National Guard before the war started?
Yes, I had. They were taken prisoners at Bataan. In fact, a good friend of mine, I was in Bataan, and he was had been transported from Bataan. They made him walk.
Yeah, all those National Guard troops from New Mexico, the bulk of them, were taken there, and there were more soldiers from New Mexico on the Bataan Death March than any other state. And there's a great memorial there in Las Cruces to that. So I guess it's a good thing that your family moved from New Mexico to California, huh?
I guess, yes.
What was life like growing up in Fresno as the oldest of 13 children? I want people to hear that. 13 children. Was that a big job to be the big brother to 12 others?
Well, since my dad was a railroad employee, Southern Pacific, they always furnished housing for their personnel. I remember I grew up in this section. It's on G Street on the west side, and they had a big 12-foot wood fence that isolated us from the rest of the world. I lived there until I went to grammar school. Then my dad got transferred. That's when I had to go from Columbia to Franklin School, elementary school. Then from there, I went to Edison for a little while because I didn't like it anyway. And I wanted to become an automobile mechanic, and so I went to Fresno Tech. I transferred. I used to walk from Clady, which is in front of Edison High School, all the way to Fresno Tech, which is on O Street, every day. Every day I walked to and fro.
Kept you in shape, I guess. And I'm sure that Fresno was a much different place then than it is now. What do you remember about those times fondly? What were the good things about Fresno in the 30s?
You can always hear the clank, clank, clang of the streetcars that we used to have. And they finally got rid of those. Growing up, when I lived on Kern Street in front of Edison High School, we had a lot of excitement on Mayor Street. Which was about maybe half a mile from my house. The law enforcement, they circled the house that he was in, and they got him. They had to do him good because he wouldn't give up. He took this house for refuge, and they found that he was in there, and they cornered him, and they took him out in the stretcher. So.
And I'm sure you didn't know at that point that you would end up with a long career in law enforcement and deal with some guys like that.
The reason why I got in law enforcement, because when I left the service, I was a surgical technician, and I wanted to continue with that field because my doctor that I worked with has so much faith in me, so I figured he must know what he's talking about.
And we'll get to that. Tell me about getting through with high school and what was going on in the world at that time. She graduated from Fresno Tech in 1939, and things were starting to happen in other parts of the world, not necessarily America just yet.
No, at this time, Hitler was doing his act. And I was an avid reader of the Fresno Bee. I always followed up all the things. And then when he tied up with Mussolini, That's what I knew. And they had England on her knees by then. Churchill made a speech I'll never forget. He said, "Never will so many owe so much to such few." He was talking about the Royal Air Force. They were outnumbered by the Germans 10-1, but they went out and met them every time. Yeah, and I'll never forget that speech as long as I live.
So you're reading about this war that's going on half a world away, but you have the feeling we're not going to be able to avoid this?
No, it's not when Mussolini tied up with them. As it turned out to be a fact.
Yeah, you saw it coming. And so what'd you do about it? You decided to sign up?
Yes, I heard about the National Guards, and we trained once a month. And I could see the situation in Europe get so serious that I couldn't understand why the governments of the United States did step in sooner than when they did. So I went ahead and joined the National Guards. I wanted to get some experience.
And what was that like for you? Was there a moment in all that training that was welcome to the Army, or, you know what, this is tougher than I thought it was going to be?
Knowing the fact that I was going to get experience, it made me feel good inside, that at least I wasn't going to go in there cold feet. I knew what to expect, and it was true.
So what about the other guys in uniform? How did they treat you? Did you make some friendships pretty quickly, or was that tough?
Well, being Mexican, it took a while for them to accept me. And once they accepted it, well, then I progressed pretty good. I got promoted twice. I was three times in 1 month, but the rules are you can only get promoted twice. No, after they got to know me, I did real well, yeah.
And I know you're not looking for anyone to feel sorry for you. You're not trying to tell a sob story here, but you said that after they got used to, were there some times where you felt that, you know, they were picking on you or discriminating against you because of your heritage?
Yes, I did. Yes, I really did. And so what I did for that, we was in formation, and there was promotions being made, and I knew that I was more qualified than they were. So I challenged to give tests. So they did. But they never showed the results, and yet I could see what was going on. So I went to my first sergeant, and his name was Sam. He wound up the sheriff's office also. And I told him, I said, "Why don't you post the results of the tests?" Because there was people there that got promoted. They were strong, and they were rough. And invariably, "Al, what do you think we ought to do?" See. And I remember this the medical officer, his name was Gidley. He had this information, and he brought this deal about there's been some concern about the results of the examination not being posted, what have you. God, pretty soon, my name come up. I made PFC, and before the month was up, they made me a corporal, and then they were going to make me a sergeant. But they couldn't do it. They couldn't do it. So they can't run three promotions in 1 month. Mm-hmm. And then from then on in, things worked out. I became in the sheriff's office, and I went from a plain deputy into senior criminologist. I was in charge of the criminal, the investigation part.
Back in those early days of the service, you said it took them a while to get used to you being Mexican. Were there any other Mexican-American or Latino soldiers?
Oh, yes. You'd think it was a Mexican army. They had three brothers. So I went to my first sergeant to tell him, I said, "Hey, we have three brothers, the Enrique brothers. It's not the policy for us, for the United States, to have members of the family in the same unit." He said, "Yeah, but they don't want to leave. They don't want to leave each other." But they finally sent one of them home. Yeah, one of the youngest ones.
What was the most challenging aspect of your training, the toughest thing to pass or to get through or to deal with?
I know there were some trying times, but I'll tell you, when they needed my attention, I gave it all I had. And my doctor that I worked with, he had a lot of confidence in me.
And how was it that you got on that path? Because I'm sure it wasn't something when you signed up, you checked a box and said, "This is what I want to do." At some point, they decided that for you, I'm sure. How did that happen that you ended up as a medical technician?
My mom, when I was a little boy, I used to hear my mom complain about her chest, and found out it was her heart. So I wanted to become a heart specialist. I was able to dissect one heart because I wanted to see the chambers and the valves and all that. In the service, I never got a chance to do that. They gave me a little mannequin that I could take apart. You know, and all because of my mom. I wanted to become a specialist in the heart, you know, or become pretty proficient because of my mother. That's when I was a little baby. Yeah.
But in the service, they've got you all in there together, and this is an infantry outfit, so guys are going to be assigned to the front lines, or they'll be doing something else. How did you end up with that assignment as a medical technician?
What happened was you always have commission officers running. Each company has a medical unit assigned to them. That unit is also overseen by commissioned officers. Evidently, they saw how involved I was and everything, that they gave me a chance to really get involved in when somebody was hurt and what have you. Evidently, I must have been doing pretty good because they had a lot of faith in me.
Tell me about December 7th. I like to ask every veteran, because every veteran has a memory of the day that Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. Where were you and how'd you find out?
I was already in the service. We had just come back from Washington for a month's training.
And that's Washington State, Fort Lewis, not Washington, D.C., yeah?
Fort Lewis, yeah. Uh-huh. I used to come home every weekend because I was a non-com. And then I had two fellows from New York. They said to me, the reason why you go home every weekend is because you can't score here. He says, because I only had two buses with 60 or 70 women in it for 1,000 soldiers, mm-hmm. you know. And he says, you can't score. So on December the 6th, I stayed, and I went to the dance. Mm-hmm. And no time at all. Boy, I'm doing my thing out in the thing. And so in the morning, it was Sunday morning, and I was the tent captain. The guys, come on now, let's go. I said, no, I'm tired. And the first one, here they come. And I had the radio. I said, being tent captain, you turn the lights off, you turn them on, and right. on radio. And they come, and they woke me up. Wake up. And they said, what's the best? We're at war. And so, what do you mean we're at war? He says, who are we at war with? The Japanese. Oh, really? I didn't even know who they were. He says, turn on the radio. So I turned the radio on, and boy, that's all you could hear, especially the attack on Pearl Harbor. Oh. By nightfall, we had moved from San Luis Obispo. We were in the hills down in lower California. We were so poorly equipped and everything. Our biggest gun was a 75-millimeter anti-tank gun.
What did that mean to you? Did that impact you on an emotional level here? You'd been focused on what's happening around the world. You had a sense war was coming, but now that America had been attacked, what did that do to you?
Well, there was so much going on that personal opinions, I don't recall really getting excited about it one way or the other. The only thing that I was concerned about was that how poorly equipped we were. Our rifles, they were using World War I, single action, no magazines or nothing like that, single action, bolt action. This is a Springfield rifle.
Well, yeah, you may have been poorly equipped. World War I helmets, too. I've seen the pictures. But you guys sure did spring into action. Within 24 hours of the attack on Pearl Harbor, the 40th Division had left San Luis Obispo and fanned out all over Southern California. They even employed Greyhound buses with CHP escorts. The threat of a Japanese attack on the California coast had troops from your regiment on Catalina Island in Santa Monica, Ventura. What were you thinking, Al? It sounds so surreal.
I couldn't understand why a young guy like myself was so concerned about the world situation as it stood at that time, when we were given a lot of experience by the world leaders in Europe, mm-hmm. mainly Hitler, and then Mussolini joined him. England was—they were getting knocked all over. And then that speech that Churchill made—I'll always remember that.
What about the speech that Roosevelt made? Did you hear that on December 8th?
When they hit Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt—you know—he had a distinct voice in his song, and what he made that speech about what had happened. I was so proud of him that that someone finally got attention of what was going on and all that. And he said a few things, and I used to know them vividly. He made a wonderful speech. I really thought a lot of it. He died while I was overseas. Just before Roosevelt died, I was overseas. There was rumors that I was coming home. But that's when Sergeant Major Halleck comes to me, says, okay, I'll sign this thing. And I looked at it. I says, what is this? He says, don't you want to become a gentleman? I says, well, let me go talk to my captain. So I went to my captain, and he says, I already know about it, Al. They've already approached me. They're going to commission me. He says, don't take it, because we're going to be, like, I'll tell you before you leave why I'm telling you this. And when got ready to leave, I went to say goodbye to him. He said, I'm going to tell you why. He says, we're having an engagement with the near future, and they estimate the casualty rate to be in around 98%, which is pretty high. But he didn't give me too much info at that time. Yeah. And when I did leave, he did call me, and he told me in Japan they have wharves sticking out, and everybody thought that people went out there to relieve themselves. What they had machine gun units in each one of those things. So you can imagine us coming off the landing boats, and those guys with the machine guns, they 98% would have made it. But my captain, he said, no, Al, you go home. You've already done your share, if not more, than a lot of people. He says, when I get home, I'll send for you. Because he says, you have the equivalent of a two-year pre-med student in the States right now. So thank you. Thank you very much, he says. But be sure and get a year's college. So I came home and went to night school for a couple of months to get adjusted. Then I went to City College and got my diploma from them, Associate of Science.
Yes, and you would go on to a long career in law enforcement, a criminologist with the Fresno County Sheriff's Department. But those post-war plans with your captain never materialized. We're going to explore that when we come back. And as far as that warning to get out when he could, that high casualty rate the doctor mentioned for the impending invasion of Japan, we know now that Al's division, the 40th Infantry Division, was to have been part of the spearhead for Operation Olympic, the first stage of that planned invasion. Mr. Flores is thankful he didn't have to experience that, but he did have some very close calls in combat, and we'll talk about them when Hometown Heroes continues after this. One of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that their real sincerity and a genuine spirit are things that really make an impression on me. And that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years. I've heard them say it's all about serving their members, and then I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, EECU demonstrates over and over again what 200,000 members already know. EECU takes you personally. Go to myeecu.org to find out for yourself, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need a thousand words, just two of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, two more. Ming's Restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you two more. Las Banas. That's where I grew up. And I'm guessing Las Banas is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat. Period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Cito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just gotta go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Las Banas, California.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 93-year-old Albert Flores of Fresno, California. He is in pretty impressive shape for a guy his age, and before he turns 94 in July, he's going to take a trip to Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight so he can see the National World War II Memorial. Al was a medical technician with the 185th Regimental Combat Team, part of the 40th Infantry Division, the Sunshine Division with those radiant golden sun patches on their shoulders. His first taste of combat came in May of 1944 on the island of New Britain in Papua New Guinea. The 40th was relieving the 1st Marine Division, which had taken the island for the most part. And the official division history describes one very important operation, that's how they put it, that took place there on New Britain with a small task force from the 2nd Battalion of the 185th Infantry. And you were part of that.
We went to Hoskins Aerodrome. We took Hoskins Aerodrome. The Japanese had already evacuated, but they had saturated with landmines. And I was on a trail, and we sent a squad in because there was some high brush between us and the ocean, and they could have had a machine gun unit or something like that. So they sent a squad in, and all of a sudden, they did step on a landmine. And you just react just like, you don't think about nothing. And so I took off, and then it dawned on me, so I stopped and I saw everybody. There was my assistants were coming. I said, "Go back to the trail, go back to the trail, and come back on my footsteps." I said, "Now, if you go, you're in charge. If you go, you're in charge." And so I wanted to be sure that we get to the injured. And so I continued, and sure enough, the two buddies of mine that I had.
I'm sorry. I know that's not an easy thing to talk about. And I've spoken to some other veterans who had to deal in situations like that with landmines and see the destruction and see what happened to them. So you lost two buddies that day?
I got them lined up, and then they followed my... I didn't give myself any consideration. I was just thinking about what I was going to run into. And sure enough, but besides my two buddies, there was some more there. And so I gave them all a quick check. And I did what I could for the most serious ones and what have you.
And so I understand. It sounds like you were only going out there to try to help guys who had already been wounded by a mine, right?
Right, yes. Uh-huh. We did what we could for the wounded. And a landmine is disastrous, boy, I'll tell you. We had an idea that it was a mine, and so they brought in the minesweepers. Mm-hmm. And they walk around with that little wand. Mm-hmm. And they found quite a few, too. So, but luckily, no more casualties from the landmines. So we work as a team, you know. Yeah. Everybody has their responsibilities and what to do.
And it sounds like that may have been the first moment, perhaps not the last, but the first moment where you were faced with that reality that easily could have been you, that you could have been the one not coming home?
That's true. That's true, yeah. But you know what? When action takes place, you forget about everything. I mean, you don't forget it. You know what you have to do. Mm-hmm. And what you have to do is priority over everything else. And you do all to the best of your ability. You don't even think about yourself.
So you're never scared?
Well, I don't think you have time to get scared. It's a funny feeling. You're in imminent danger, but you're also trained to accept the situation and do the best you can to resolve the situation.
You said you never had time to get scared. Was there anything that gave you confidence that you would survive? I mean, maybe from your family back home or faith or just encouragement? Was there something that made you believe, you know what, I am going to come back home and I am going to have a life?
When you see incidents take place, and invariably sometimes when you, like me talking to you, then I go out the back door and you go out the front door, and then I come in the front door and you're gone. That's how fast it'll happen, especially when you're dealing with snipers. Reality is something that's going to happen no matter what. You're doing the best you can.
So it sounds like you were kind of resigned to the fact that what's going to happen is going to happen. There's nothing I can do about it?
That's right. I carried a belt. And I had a couple of pouches, nothing but quarter grain morphine, cigarettes. Then my other pouches, in that time during the war, the sulfur company, we had sulfur pills, you had sulfur ointment. I had a little bit of everything around me. And then I had some sedatives also that I could give to a victim instead of a morphine, because morphine is pretty potent. And it would be a pain depressor, stuff like that. You have to react as fast as you can, but also properly. You don't want to give someone morphine when you can give them something else that'll do the same thing and not endanger them so much. I'll give you a good example. You're going down a road in your car. You're following the speed limit. Then you have this other person breaking every law there is and hit you. And you have passengers, and you're trapped in there, and you have somebody in your, and you see how badly they're hurt. There's not much you can do because you're trapped in there too. Right. That's kind of thing. And the only thing that would stop me from doing what I if I became a casualty, you don't think about anything else.
Obviously, that landmine situation was a close call for you, and one that left you with some real hurt for the guys that were lost. But I'm sure that wasn't the only situation that you encountered the enemy or something the enemy was trying to do to you.
We were moving inland. We didn't want to get on in the boats. We went inland. We're going this single file. On this trail, a sniper takes a shot at us. And what they were doing now, they would tie themselves to the tree in case they got shot at, that that they wouldn't fall down. See, here's the captain, here's me, and here's my other assistant. And the captain, I was always standing up, and I said, because he's a medical officer, I said, "Doctor, get down. And pretty soon, all I heard was thud. A sniper had shot at us. But we didn't hear the sound or nothing, but we did hear the thud where it hit. So it had to be pretty close to one of the three of us would have got it that way.
But it hit a tree or something?
We were in open land. There's ravines and there's little knolls, and then there's a big hill over there with trees in it. And you can always bet your butt that there's a sniper in there. And this guy must have shot us, because of the old saying, you'll never hear the shot to get you. We didn't hear it. All we heard was thud.
So what do you do in a situation like that?
I always carried a smoke grenade with me, a live grenade and a smoke grenade. So I got everybody down. And can you imagine me telling the captain, get down? Anyhow, I took my smoke grenade and I moved the brush a little bit to see which way the wind was blowing. So we had to go this way. So I took the grenade, I pulled the pin. I said, okay, on three, back to where we were, and we go zigzag. I said, when I say three, we go. So I pulled the pin. I knew which way the wind was blowing this way. So I wanted the smoke to go this way, because we're going to go with the smoke. So I pulled the pin, I threw the grenade, and I said, one, two, three, go. Boy, and away we went. We were in the smoke.
Do you feel like that saved your lives?
In a situation like that, I would say that it saved our lives for a while anyway.
Yeah, you weren't out of the woods.
Wasn't out of the woods yet. Yeah, no. And you know that fellow is after you. And so you know one consequence for sure. You know, so it's up to you, faith, I guess, and hope that you'll be able to shake hands with your friends again.
Because it sounds like he had a pretty clean shot at you guys.
Yeah.
So if you hadn't reacted that way, that quickly, things could have been a lot different. My question is, were you trained to react that way, or is that something that just occurred to you in the moment?
We have to act according to the circumstances. If this had been a shell, a big shell, you have a crater to contend with, and definitely more damage, physical damage. And when you're dealing with a single shot, you know it's a sniper. And you don't know how many there's out there. The idea is to get back to where some sort of safety or get where you're not a target. When a sniper's shooting at you, you know that he's settled and he's not going to move back and forth. Like the knee motors, the Japanese had knee motors, and they could fire two rounds. Oh, God. I don't know who this little kid was, But we had just moved into the top of this hill, and this kid come to me, and he's got a smile on his face. And I heard this, the neem water coming. And, and the louder it sounds, the closer it's coming to you. And he got, see where that stand is right there? He was about that far from me. And I know that the neem water came this way because it must have hit him right here, because when I turned him over, he was as black as this all over. Just a young kid, just a young, young kid. I checked him out right away, and I knew he was gone. So there was some more people, and the reason it saved me is because when I heard the neem water coming in, it had a sun, and knowing that they used two at a time. And boy, I knew the second was coming, so boy, I went to one side, and of course he didn't do nothing. He never felt a thing. And as soon as I waited for the second one, it did show up. So I jumped up and I turned him over, and his face complexion was the same color, just black. And I'll never forget that as long as I live. And then one of my friends, he come around and he says, "Al," he says, "you're bleeding." I said, "What do you mean I'm bleeding?" And he says, "You are, where?" He says, "In your face." I went like this. Boy. Wow! I went like this, and because I had some more wounded, and it must have been a shrapnel that must have got me.
From the same one that killed that boy?
Yeah, it had to be. Now, if that guy would have fired the second mortar, he'd have got me too, I'm sure. But I went this way, and my young friend, he didn't know what hit him. But when I turned him around, he was powder burned, just black as could be. He never knew what hit him.
So you're going around trying to tend to the wounded, and they tell you, hey, you're bleeding too.
I didn't even know. Well, the only thing I could think of is this eye, years later, I went to an eye doctor. He says, Al, he says, your retina's been bleeding for quite some time. Now, this is 15, 20 years later. The others, ophthalmologists, they couldn't find nothing wrong with it. And he took a picture of my retina in the back, and he said, yeah, you've been bleeding for a long time. In fact, I'm still concerned about it now. But they still don't do nothing about it. They won't do.
But your suspicion is that's because of that mortar attack.
I have an idea it was that.
I'm sure at some point you get desensitized to some of the things that you're dealing with. But can you help us understand? Because we talk about World War II, and we think about 405,000 Americans who died in the war, and so many more wounded. And you saw a lot of that firsthand. What, when you'd get in a situation like that, how would you figure out who to help and when and how much they needed?
You attend to as many as you can, and you have to decide. It could be the wrong decision, but you have to decide who you're going to do first. Some of those people that got hit by whatever bombs, whatever the source was, will have different degrees of wounds on them. For example, like a landmine or a bomb, something like that. You never can tell just how bad it is. You just have to evaluate and then do what you can with what you have.
And was that where most of your experience was, out in the field trying to help guys right after they're wounded? Or were you at an aid station where they'd bring them to you? Or what was most of your work?
Well, this doctor that I worked with, the philosophy in the armed service was you have aid men. They go out with the troops themselves. One aid man to maybe 30 people. And then they have a field station, which sits back quite a ways. And then you have your base hospital. Depending on the situation, naturally the first aid man is the first person there. But this captain that I worked with, he took the base station with him. That was him and I. I had an autoclave kit on my back, and I had that belt. I knew all the instruments and everything by name and everything, and he had one too. We'd get to a casualty, and regardless of what it was, boy, he'd go right in there. This one, that case, it was a shell. It was a demortar that tore the soldier's arm almost off. It was just hanging there. He says, "Here, Al," he says, "hold the arm up a little bit." He's tying off the arteries. He says, "Take the scissors and with the other hand and cut what skin was left." So I held the arm up. Then I took the scissors and cut the part of the flesh. And I took the, this is what I do with it now. He's busy tying off the arteries down here. Mm-hmm. Fantastic fellow.
So a field amputation, basically.
Yes, yeah. We had to take the arm off anyway.
Yeah.
And then the other fellow that was hurt pretty bad, that was May the 7th. They sent a PT boat from 60 miles away, and they sent me home back to this to the base station in the PT boat. The JJ says to me, Doc, he says, give me a time to get out in the ocean. He says, then it'll be a smooth ride. So I tied my friend down on the litter. Then I wrapped my arms around him and held him. And was getting out to heavy seas.
Bouncing through the waves, huh?
Yeah. And he says, okay, Doc, we're going to go now. And all he did, he goes so fast, here's the waves, and the only time it just hits the high wave. Yeah. So, but you're going smooth. And I'm hanging on to him. He said, you can let him go now. And we got him back to, and I don't know what the consequences were, because I had to get another 50 boat and come back.
Yeah, you had to tend to more wounded, and there are plenty of them. And while you would come back from the war, you're here talking to me, that captain who had mentored you and encouraged you and said he had plans for you in the field of medicine after the war, he didn't come home.
Remember I tell you about the three of us standing in that thud? Well, the other fellow's name was Crosby, so we called him Bing Crosby. And he made a trip to California to tell me that the captain was killed.
I know that had to be devastating for you. And I know that captain was very courageous. I want to talk about the way you approached your duties and the way you described taking the hospital to the front lines. But right now, we've got to take a break. The rest of 93-year-old Al Flores' story when Hometown Heroes continues right after this. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkernCounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, CVHonorFlight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. 93-year-old Albert Flores of Fresno, California, our guest today, served as a medical technician with the 185th Regimental Combat Team, 40th Infantry Division in the Pacific during World War II. You've heard him mention a lot about his captain, the doctor he served under, treating the wounded, of which there were many. You described the equipment the two of you would carry on your backs, medical equipment that often would have been back in an aid station or a field hospital. But your captain mobilized that to where the casualties were. And that philosophy, that approach, was that something that he was instructed or authorized to do? Or is that an idea he came up with on his own?
That was his idea.
And what did you think about it? Did you feel like you guys did more good or saved more lives that way?
If we saved one life, it was well worth it. If we only saved one life, we was well worth it. And I know we saved several. But it's funny, when you get in a situation like that, you forget about everything else. You can hear bullets going over your head and all that stuff, but well, you're so busy doing what you're going to do.
And you mentioned calling your buddy Crosby being Crosby, but I understand you had a nickname in the service as well. It wasn't Al Flores.
No, because I used to call everybody Jackson, you know, Jackson, because like we used to give influenza shots and all that stuff. We'd shoot maybe 800 people nowadays, about maybe 400 or 500 at a time.
They'd line up, you give them a shot, and they move on through, yeah?
And you have a team. The team fills up the syringe and everything. To me, I called everybody Jack, you know, it's easier to remember. And so they called me Jack, too. Oh, let me tell you, when we left before the war and everything, it belonged to the National Guards. Out of Fresno alone, right here, there was 300 some of us that left there. I remember that night, and I went to shake hands with my dad, and he wouldn't shake hands. He said, "You'll be back." Yeah.
He didn't want you to say goodbye.
I went to shake hands, and he said, no. He says, "You'll be back."
You mentioned your dad. It makes me wonder, did you ever get much mail from home?
We used to have mail call, but sometimes because of our, when you were committed, you didn't get mail. I guess they must have started a program here of some sort, write letters to your serviceman. If you know of a serviceman, write him a letter. And I got a letter from some girl in Chicago. And I think I still have some of her letters for Easter. She'd always send me a box of chocolate candy. For all the holidays, she'd always send me, every time. It got to the point when on the holiday, here comes all the guys, and they said, "What are you doing? I'm waiting for Jack to get his veil." And sure,
they could get some chocolate from you?
Yeah.
What did that mean to you, that a random stranger, someone you'd never met, cared enough to send that stuff to you?
It's a good feeling. You look forward to the next mail call.
Well, one of the areas where your division suffered a lot of casualties but also produced a big victory, and your regiment was involved in this, was Luzon in the Philippines, capturing that part of the Philippines. What do you remember about all that, and where were you while that was all going on?
I was on a third wave. And my first mission was to go across this field. That's when that cow, this big black and white cow, when they prepare a landing, there's a bombardment by the battleships, and then the Air Force comes and they drop their bombs and all. And this used to be an airfield that the Japanese used, and it's pretty wide. And Captain told me, "So you got a special assignment. As soon as we hit the shore, we're in a third wave, and you're to go straight to this designated place." And they give you a mock map and everything. And so you're almost there before you're there, because they've drilled you. So when I got there, I could see the craters. And so I went from crater to crater. Our Air Force was bombing the weeks before we got there. And then when the landing parties come in, then your cruisers and some destroyers, they lob shells into. Then when you see the formation, like the B-24s come over and they drop their load of bombs, I mean, it just everything just erupts. It's just like taking a bunch of gravel in a lake and just throwing it in. You know how the water gets. All I wanted to do was to get to my destination, and do what I had to do, and then come back. But I had to get there first. So I jumped into a couple of craters first. Then I looked up, and there's this black and white Jersey cow looking at me. First thought to my mind, how could that cow survive all this bombardment? And if that cock survived, there must be a bunch of nips around me. So instead of passing three or four craters, I was hitting every other crater by jumping a crater, and then I jump out and go to the other one. And of course, it took me longer to get where I was going, but at least I was going to get there. But that was really sad. I'll never forget that cow as long as I live.
I bet.
I was picked out to go across this open field to make sure that the other battalion landed all right. And that was going to be our signal. When I went like this, and then the guy that went in the back, same thing. So that was, we accomplished our mission, so we had to get back. But what got me was I couldn't get that cow off out of my mind. Here I'm going through the ground, and here's this cow sitting, and alive as could be. I could just visualize 100 snipers.
One thing that always strikes me, because now we look back and we know how long it lasted and when it started and when it was over. Yeah. But when you're in it, you don't know when it's going to be over. Yeah. How did you deal with that uncertainty or that constant nature of being on edge and not knowing what was going to happen next?
You know what I think it is? In my case, it was close friends that I lost. That was hard. then there's a case, I'll put it this way. We were going to move out, but so they always send a patrol ahead. So these patrol was going to go ahead. And this one fellow in the patrol, he says, Al, he says, can you do something about my knee? I says, what's wrong with it? So he come over and he says, my knee, it just keeps jumping out of place. I says, well, raise your pants legs. So I checked it out. And I said, let me put an ace bandage on here. And so I put an ace bandage to give you support. He says, when we get to, yeah, I want you to come back and see me as soon as we go where we're going. And so one of his sergeants hollered, hey, what do you get? Come on. He said, he made some sort of remark. So I slapped this ace bandage on him, and I tightened it up. I said, how's that feel? He said, it feels pretty good. I said, okay, now don't forget, when we get to where we're going, I want you to come back to me. And so he says, okay. So he took off. I saw him take off, and I went about my business. And then later on, I'm walking the same plane. I saw this body with a tarp on it. And I went and picked it up, and it was him. He couldn't have been over 100 yards from where I wrapped him. And I saw the body, and I thought, God. So I pulled a tarp over, and it was him. But then this thing's happening that's already done with. So you go and take care of the next problem coming up. So, but it's pretty rough. Just like my two buddies that stepped on that landmine the night before, they got into a fight with one another. And it was my turn to take care of the night duties. And they came in there, I had them bleeding. I says, now this, and I says, we didn't come here to fight one another. We came here to fight the Japs. He says, now next time this happens, I'm going to take the both of you, and I'm going to just crunch you and make you understand that we're not here to fight one another. They both could have taken me with one hand. And okay, all right. And I'll be a son of a gun next day. There they were.
Have you ever thought about the fact that you did lose buddies over there, that so many didn't get to come home, but you did come home, that the landmine didn't get you, that the sniper didn't get you, that none of the artillery or enemy fire ever got you?
Now, this is what really makes you upset, and it makes everybody upset. Our airplanes, there's this hill here, there's this ravine down here. We were going to take that land. So we call for air support. The P-38s, are you familiar with the P-38? Okay, they come along and they drop, we're sitting up here, and they get down here and they drop these napalm bombs. Then here comes the P-40s and they strafe. Then comes the A-20s and they drop bombs. And we have our panels showing our
who you guys are, identifying you. Yeah.
Here's the panels, and we're back here yet, see? So we're watching this. It's like being at a movie. You know, you've seen of the B-24s coming from high elevation, and then you see the P-38s and the P-40s and the A-20s. And they look up, and here comes some A-20s. They fly in threes. I'm standing right here. They're coming this way. And we're going to go that way. This A-20 goes by us. They drop their parachute bombs. This other A-20, when he got about from here, say about 100 yards, I see things open up. What the hell is he doing? And all of a sudden, the bombs, they were black with yellow stripes with white lettering. Here they come. They come right. I bet if I'd have gone this, I could have touched the tip of the bomb.
That close to you?
Yeah, the kid was singing back and forth. They released them, and here, you're me. It came like this, right over my head. One of them hit closer than the rest of them, but we knew it was three. And then when it was over and done with, I saw a hand sticking out. And I thought, oh, my God. And then I was so like that. So I took off my helmet, and boy, I dug. Dug his game of breathing there. And another fellow over there said, hey, come over here and keep digging this guy out. And it's because I figured it has some more casualties. What made that pilot release those bombs? And the bombs, I could read the writing on them. You know what I thought? That was a Japanese crew that got into this formation. Of course, that's pretty far-fetched, but that's how could
there were instances of that in both Europe and Japan, but and then there are plenty of cases of just miscommunication and error. But so basically, the impact was this friendly fire, this bomb, killed Americans. Were you able to dig that guy out of the bomb crater?
Oh yeah, we got him. I had this other fellow. I took my helmet off and dug, cleared him. Then I had another guy finish it, and then I forget now how many casualties I had. But I was so mad. The colonel, it was a ranking officer. Yeah. I was still raving mad about that. And he says, well, next time, he says, we'll shoot them down ourselves.
And that happened in the war also. That's the unfortunate truth. So there's another instance where it could have been you. Do you feel that somebody was looking out for you this whole time? Because you were in from before the war started to near the end and all those situations?
I was sitting down like you are.
Yeah.
And I'm like this. And I feel like this. Uh-huh. And I look up. And there stands in front of me this little guy. He couldn't have been over 5'5". And he had a uniform on and everything. And he says to me, Sergeant, you're going to go to heaven. And no, I just thought about it. I've been thinking about this so many times. And the other day, it dawned, how do you know I was a sergeant? Because we don't carry insignias to tell you who you are, you know, especially if you got rank. And now, if I was an enemy, and if you were an enemy, and I had identification, say I'm a lieutenant or something like that, and I have a private, who would you shoot first? It never dawned on me until not too long ago. Now, wait a minute. How in the world did he know I was a sergeant? I didn't have an insignia. But here's the thing. I looked up and he said, Sergeant, you're going to go to heaven. And he moved on. And I didn't check this uniform. Do you remember Satsack in the newspaper?
Uh-huh, sure.
Yeah, he was dressed something like him. Uh-huh. Anyway, so there was some other soldiers over there. So I went over there and asked him. I says, hey, I says, which way did that fellow go? He says, what guy? He says, a little while ago, this fellow just came by. And he says, we didn't see anybody. I says.
So you're sitting there burying your head in your hands. Someone touches you on the shoulder, tells you, Sergeant, you're going to go to heaven. And no one else ever saw the guy.
No. And finally, one guy said, he says, you know what? That was an angel. I says, are you sure? He says, then it dawned on me, how did you know I was a sergeant? I didn't have an insignia. Yeah. And these guys never saw him. Mm-hmm. And then I went down the road asking, where did that fellow go? Because he didn't have a gun or nothing. He just had an old sloppy uniform on. It was an army uniform, but yeah. It was all wrinkled up and everything. But he did tell me, he says, you're going to go to heaven. Mm-hmm. And I've never forgotten that.
I don't blame you. And I guess the follow-up question I have, in that moment, given where you were, when someone says, you're going to go to heaven, to me, I say, well, is he talking about real soon, or can I wait a while? That could have a couple different meanings there. How did you take it?
Yeah, I had too much in my mind. I let it go. In fact, the only reaction I got was when I went and asked these other fellows if they saw where this fellow went. They said, we didn't see anybody. I said, yeah, just a little while ago. Didn't have a rifle or nothing. I've often wondered about that fellow. Funny things happen.
Yeah. I'll tell you, Al, you have shared your story in a way that helps the rest of us understand what it must have been like. And the emotion that we hear in your voice as you recall those assuring words from a stranger, or maybe, as you said, an angel in the middle of a battle zone, that's something I know is going to stick with us. Mr. Flores, thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us about it. I look forward to hearing about your journey to the World War II Memorial with Honor Flight. Excited about that. But we're out of time for today. If you at home really enjoyed 93-year-old Al Flores and his story today, I do have a few more of his memories included on the podcast version at hometownheroesradio.com. It'll also be on the CDs Mr. Flores receives, made possible by my friends at EECU and their sponsorship of Hometown Heroes. Until next time, I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you were reminded again today through the candid memories of a spirited veteran of that reality that I hope we as Americans will never forget. Freedom is not free. Well, you told us a story about your captain telling you to turn down the commission, to not accept that, and to go home. What was it like coming home, seeing America again, seeing your family again? Tell me about that.
Okay. I had to go back to Leyte. And when I got to Leyte, they said anybody can type. If you type shipping orders, you'll be on the next ship. So being a typist, I did my 18 of them, you know, and I turned them in, and he says, get your stuff ready because you'll be on the shipping. So every night you'd go out and they'd read the names of the people that were gonna go. So I'm sitting there, and they're calling all kinds of names. No Albert Flores. So I went to the headquarters, and I typed my quota, and I'm supposed to be on that ship. I'm supposed to be on that shipping list. And they said, well, he said, you're not. And this smart ass, oops.
That's
all right. He says, you want to be served of, I forget what he said. It was an insulting remark. Anyway, so I was there, then a lieutenant came by, and I'm raising my voice up quite a bit. And he said, what seems to be the trouble? Then another soldier told him, he says that he typed the required amount of shipping orders for the tomorrow's ship, and his name wasn't on it. And he says, what happened? And it says, because that guy over there, that fellow over there, took his name off, took his application off. Flores, you know. I went up to him. I said, you know what? I don't know how much power I've got, if any, but I'm going to have them put you in my outfit that I just left. And then the lieutenant says, I've heard enough. He says, he better be aboard ship tomorrow or all of you are going to go to the front line. It was a second lieutenant told the guys that in the office there. Uh-huh. He says, if he's not on the shipping list tomorrow, I said, all of you get your stuff ready because you're going to go to the front. And I don't know whether it did or not, because I was on a shipping list the next day. Oh, and it was a ship with the troops from the east, mm-hmm. from the east. And being who I was, anybody that was sick on deck, I would take attend to them. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know this because I didn't know anybody. Mm-hmm. And I did that, and then the next day I got aboard ship, what have you, and then I started helping the people that were on the same ship. And when we got past Hawaii, then they could show movies on deck. So I forget what I was doing. Anyhow, they says, come on, Doc, says, the movie's started. I says, okay. So I get up, get up on deck, and I'm walking towards the screen, and two guys come up and they pick me up, and they says, "Come on, Doc, come on, Doc." And they had a chair. There's the screen. Here's a chair. And the guy, I don't know who he was, he gets in front of the screen, yeah. And he tells, "Okay, see this chair? This chair is going to be here, and no one gets this chair, no matter what, until the doc gets here. The doc, this is the doc's chair. And anyone who gets on it, he's mud." And you know what? I didn't have to worry about getting the chair. I knew where it was. And these guys, when we got to San Francisco, because they had let me off, they went and tried to get the captain to make an error and take me to the East Coast.
They liked you that much, huh?
Yeah, they did. God.
Was it just that they were so appreciative of all the medical help that you gave them?
I guess. What I was doing was just what I always did, you know. But I didn't think nothing about it or nothing. And when I saw that, he says, "Come on, Doc." And then he got in front of the screen. He says, "Look, this is the doc. And see that chair? That's his chair. Nobody sits in that chair."
Yeah. Sounds like that was worth more to you than any medal could have been or anything. What was it like to see your family again after everything you'd been through?
Well, I got home on a Friday night at midnight, and at the station, it was close to midnight. I got a taxi cab, and I told him the address that I lived at. I used to live near the Chandler Airfield. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Don't leave until I wave at you." So I went to the front door, and knocked on the door, and they turned on, "Oh, Al!" And I says, "They're here." So I told the driver, "You can go." And then, yeah, it was about midnight when I woke up the family, my grandmother and my aunt. And it was my first night home. It was, before I left, my dad was having babies every 2 years. How he did it, I don't know. Every 2 years. And I told him before I left, I says, "If you have one more baby, I'm moving out." Sure enough, so I moved with my grandmother. Oh, dear.
Yeah, the oldest of the 13 has a little different perspective than the youngest of the 13, I'm sure. Yeah. And you told us a story about how your captain had thought so highly of your skills in the medical field and thought you could have been a doctor yourself. Then he gets killed overseas, and you ended up spending 21 years with the Fresno County Sheriff's Department. What are you most proud of with your law enforcement career?
Excuse me?
What gives you the most pride in what you accomplished in law enforcement?
Like I said before, when I found out that they had a crime lab, and then within a crime lab, they also had an autopsy lab. Mm-hmm. And that's what I went through. You have to go through the different phase of training. You have to go in as a jailer, then you become a bailiff, then you become a patrolman, and then you work. And I jumped from jail to the crime lab. Mm-hmm. And I really, really enjoyed my duties.
Did you get a sense of satisfaction that the work you were doing was helping the people that you were serving, that the right people were getting convicted of crimes, or that people were being brought to justice? What did you do it for? What satisfaction did you get?
you know, we're all humans. And sooner or later, you're going to slip up and do the wrong thing. And what I'm talking about now is the court system is no different than anybody else. And there's different opinions that are based, no matter what I do, what I've said, or whatever. Someone's out there is going to say he doesn't know what he's talking about and all that stuff. I know that. It's the way I feel about it is if I think of something and it's it ends up differently than what I think it should have done, I just take it as a way of life. You know, that's us. And I see it, and you see it in the papers all the days. It seems like you get, well, you see, I listen to all these different debates on TV and what have you. God. And then the people that are running the country, they've done things that, oh God, I don't see how they could do it, but they do it. So, in answer to your question, be it, so be it. And that's it.
Well, I know some of these things we've talked about haven't been easy for you, and I just want to say thank you for going back there with us. Thank you for serving our country, for telling us about it. Is there anything else that you think us younger folks, people like your children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, that when long after your generation is gone, that you think we should remember about World War II and what all you guys did for us?
Well, I would say that if they're aware of the circumstances that occur prior and after an incident takes place, if they would not just let it pass by, think about it. Do some research of some sort.
How about this? Maybe someone's asked you this before, but I know you got almost 94 years worth to think about, so there's a lot there, but what are you most thankful for with the way your life has unfolded and everything you've experienced and done? What are you most thankful for?
What I'm thankful for is, number one, and number two, right there.
Your sons.
My sons. I'm glad that they're where they're at. And in the newspaper, you see where people, their family, even they do harm to one another. Mm-hmm. And for different reasons, what have you. And my dad, the only thing I had against my dad was that he had a baby every 2 years without fail. I can't help that thing. He has to be somewhere pretty quick. Yeah. Ronnie?
I think we're good. I just wanted to get any last thoughts you had in there.
Yeah. In general, I don't think that I could ever change it. I don't think you could ever change it. There's something has to be done. The things from my personal viewpoint, there's something wrong with our system. The way we live, the way we do, how we depend on different people, how we elect individuals, and then they have all these different closed-door meetings, and they and it's a I'm not even a halfway politician, but God, some of the things that they do, they shouldn't be doing it.
Last question for you. Do you feel something when you see the American flag? Does that mean something to you?
I'll never forget when I came back from my assignment after landing and come through the brush, and there's the flag, huge flag, full waving. At the base of it, as far as I could see, there's people on a prone position. This lieutenant said, called me by name. He says, "What do you think, Al?" I says, "Everything up to phase line A or B, whatever I would call it." I think it must have been A. There was a river, and then there was a block like fence about this high. He says, "Everything's fine to there." And so he said, "Okay, go." And everybody stood up, and they moved, and the flag just, what a beautiful sight. Huge flag. God, it was. I wish I could have had a camera or something. I'll tell you, it was a beautiful, beautiful sight.
Well, you just painted the mental picture for us. So that was actually in a combat situation. So you not only saw the flag, you saw all the people that were fighting for that flag.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yes.